Soldiers had stopped what they were doing to watch the commotion. They crowded around the cart, a dozen men thick.
"The princess has arrived,"
one of them said. Anise's breath caught in her chest. All the hiding, all the fighting, was for naught.
"Princess Anise,"
another said. The men were so close they could clamber onto the cart in half a moment. Even warriors like Terin and Sir Dietrich would be unable to stop more than a small portion of them if they wanted to take her, to drag her back to her uncle at Castle Hill. Still, Terin's hand shot to his Morning Star, which he uncoiled with the clanking of chains.
"All hail, Anise Garrick, Princess of the North,"
a man said, and a cheer went up.
"What?"
Anise said. Sir Dietrich laughed loudly.
"You have nothing to fear here," he said. "Raiders Pass is ours."
While Anise tried to process the idea of being safe amongst so many northern soldiers, another voice inserted itself into the conversation. Though Anise recognized the voice as if it were her own, there was something different about it, something powerful.
"Sister?"
the voice said. Anise turned. A brother stood outside the large tent, wearing a full suit of silver armor, missing only the helmet. Though he seemed exceptionally surprised at her presence, Anise could tell from his expression that he was pleased to see her. She leapt from the cart, landing in a crouch, and then barreled toward him. She was planning on tackling him and wailing on him like she always did growing up when he'd done something stupid. He seemed to think the same thing, because he put his hands up and began backing away. At the last moment, however, she pulled up, wrapping him in an embrace, squeezing extra hard.
"If you ever run from me again, I will pop you like a grape," she hissed in his ear.
"Nice to see you too, sister," he said.
Behind them, the men cheered and pounded their chests. Anise released her brother when Aunt Zelda approached and said,
"Come inside. We have much to discuss."
Those men who supported Lord Griswold have fled toward either Blackstone or the Razor. Those who survived, that is. Sir Dietrich said the latter with satisfaction, as if he'd killed half of them himself, and chased the rest away with his sword held high. They were gathered in Arch's royal tent, Anise, Arch, Lady Zelda, Sir Craig, Sir Dietrich, and Terin, who had to duck his head to avoid hitting it on the ceiling. Anise shook her head, still trying to come to terms with the fact that her brother had managed to secure himself an army, albeit a rather small one. Arch seemed able to read her mind. "It didn't take much convincing," he said. "Most of these men have never even met Lord Griswold, and owe him no allegiance. They are tired of fighting to secure the pass, tired of treading water in the armpit of the North. I brought them something they haven't had in a while."
Anise raised her eyebrows in question.
"Hope,"
Arch explained.
"Change."
"What change?"
"An end to the war," he said. "I have promised them that if they can hang on a little longer, if they will help me to restore the North to its true heir, that I will initiate peace talks with the West."
Anise opened her mouth to speak, to inform him of what everyone had seemed to have forgotten, that Arch was not of age, and now Anise was. The true heir he spoke of so confidently was her, not him. But Zelda placed a hand on her shoulder, and stopped her with a sharp glance and barely perceptible shake of her head.
"Peace with the West may be impossible now," Zelda said. "Their king is dead, and the news of your mother's death was not taken well. She was their princess, after all."
"That was Uncle's decision, not mine," Arch said. "He tried to kill me, too. I can explain that to the Lorenz. I will make them understand."
Zelda nodded.
"I have no doubt you will try," she said.
"Have you received word of whether the line of succession has been determined?"
Arch bit his lip, an expression that finally made him look his age. Then he spoke, and the boy he'd once been gave way to the man he'd become. "We received a stream 2 days prior. Rhea Loren is of age, but has been accused of fornication under Western law."
Anise knew the West was strict on many things, but surely taking a lover wouldn't preclude the princess from inheriting the throne.
"The work of the Furia, no doubt," Zelda said, sighing. This is unfortunate news. Rhea might have been an easy ally. I assume her eldest cousin, Jove, has assumed the crown as King Temporanus.
Correct, Arch said. We streamed him a message only yesterday explaining the situation in the north, though his spies have likely already informed him. We will defend the pass while we await his reply.
What did you ask of him? Zelda said. The West is in turmoil. They are in no position to offer assistance to our cause.
I did not ask for assistance, nor do I need it, Arch said calmly. He sounded like a king. Not like her father, full of anger and fear-mongering, but strong and willful. I simply warned him of Lord Griswold's illegal seizure of the throne and his gathering of forces at Blackstone. In the event that I can defeat my uncle, I requested that we negotiate peace under new terms. Our terms, not those of our elders.
Zelda smiled thinly. You have done well.
There is something else we must discuss, Sir Dietrich said. Anise glanced at Lady Zelda sharply, knowing immediately what the knight was about to bring up. Her name day. Northern law. After hearing her brother speak, she didn't want him to know the truth. He was always meant to be the king anyway, not her. Already he'd shown his ability to rule, to make hard, fast decisions. And she'd thrown snowballs at an ice bear, defeated a lusty drunkard, and hidden amongst timber and swords. If all that made her worthy of being a queen, then she would leap atop a wild mammothen and storm Castle Hill herself. Zelda seemed to feel the same way, because she once more interjected, cutting Sir Dietrich off.
Yes, we must discuss the strategy for the impending battle. I assume preparations are complete.
Sir Dietrich frowned, but seemed to take the hint, clamping his mouth shut. Anise exhaled slowly. She would talk to the knight later, try to convince him that the truth was better kept from her brother, at least for now. Before Arch could respond to Zelda's question, Sir Craig said,
Wait, shouldn't we first consider whether we should defend the pass?
Sir Dietrich's frown deepened.
What are you suggesting? That we let the Easterners march right through, free to enter our lands unmolested?
Sir Craig raised a placating hand.
Why not? They will help our cause in the short term. If they make it to Castle Hill, they may even overthrow Lord Griswold. Why should we defend the usurper king?
Sir Dietrich opened his mouth to speak again, but Arch cut him off.
It's an interesting proposal, but why should we replace one unlawful king with another? Either way, we'll still have a rebellion to carry out.
We could reason with King Ironclad afterwards, Sir Craig went on. He might listen, especially if we made certain promises of peace.
Though she was against the proposal, Anise was pleased to see Arch well and truly consider the idea, something her father never would have done. After a moment of reflection, Arch said,
Sister, what do you think?
Anise was surprised but honored that her brother was interested in what she had to say. He really was becoming a wise king, a fact that made the weight of her secret even harder to bear.
I wish we could avoid violence at the pass, she said. But we cannot allow our anger at our uncle dictate our decisions. We are northerners, and if the East would invade our lands, we have no choice but to defend it, to the death if necessary. We have no reason to believe the Ironclads would be open to peace negotiations. Not after all the bloodshed between our kingdoms.
Arch nodded vehemently, as if her opinion had solidified his own.
I agree with my sister's wisdom.
Other opinions? There were none, and Sir Craig backed down. Arch moved on to the battle strategy. Evidently the Eastern King, or an Ironclad, the Juggernaut, had decided the North was ripe for defeat. He'd led a large battalion of soldiers from his stronghold in Feria to Raiders Pass. Given the poor weather conditions, he was expected to mount an attack through the pass soon, perhaps as early as on the morrow. Preparations had been made for just such an assault. When the pass was once dominated by the raiders of old, numerous fortifications had been built directly into the cliffs, man-made caves, offering a strong position from above. Arch had sent half of his forces to each of these outposts, hauling timber and heavy stone. These men included his best archers. The goal was to send as many of the Easterners into the frozen river as possible, before they could traverse the narrow pass and reach northern territory. However, if any of the enemy did make it through, Arch had planned accordingly. Enormous ice slings had been constructed, and were prepared to bombard any who emerged from the pass. Furthermore, his most capable swordsmen, including Sir Dietrich, as well as those with experience in hand-to-hand combat, would provide a final line of defense. The goal was victory with as few casualties as possible. They would need a heavy force to march on Castle Hill and take back the throne. Annice once more marveled at the change in her brother. He was all business, a far cry from the boy who always had a quip at her expense on his tongue. He was born to be king, and she wouldn't try to convince him otherwise. Once this was over, she would flee to the north, or possibly Crimea. But she wouldn't try to convince him to go with her. No, she couldn't ask that of him. "Explain yourself," Sir Dietrich said, grabbing Anise's arm as he caught up to her. "I don't have to explain anything to you," she spat back. Terin stepped up, moving chest to chest with the knight who'd defeated him in the melee, an event that now felt like a lifetime ago to Anise.
"Remove your hand, sir,"
Terin said. Sir Dietrich raised his eyebrows.
"I see you two have bonded out on the tundra," he said, laughing.
Still, he released his grip and pulled his hand back.
"You know nothing," Anise said.
"Really? I know that you are legally a queen now, that it is you and not Arch who should be making a claim for the throne. Regardless of your intentions, you must tell him the truth."
"I will," Anise growled, "after the battle, and I will relinquish my rights to him. He is the king. No name day can change that."
"It can, if you want it to," Sir Dietrich said.
"I don't," Anise said quickly.
The knight moved closer once more, as if daring Terin to stop him.
"What are you afraid of, Anise?"
he said, his voice husky.
"Of being adored? Of being cheered? Of being strong?"
Anise shoved him away.
"I already am strong, and adoration is for petty princes with big smiles and arrogant demeanors."
She walked away, toward the tent Arch had provided for her, while Terin stopped Sir Dietrich from following.
"If you don't tell him, I will,"
Sir Dietrich called after her. Anise had been trying to sleep for a long time. The camp was quiet and dark and, strangely, peaceful.
"The calm before the storm," she mused, rubbing her eyes.
Faintly, she could hear Terin's snores from without her tent. Though they shared a much smaller tent than this one, he refused to sleep inside, preferring to guard the entrance.
"That was survival," he'd said when she'd offered. "Now, it wouldn't be proper."
Proper, she thought now.
She hated that word, more so because it always seemed to follow her around like a chaperone.
"Don't cheer too loud at the melee, princess. It wouldn't be proper.
Don't eat too much or too fast or too loudly. It's not proper.
Don't fight with the boys or play snow wars, or do anything that could possibly be construed as fun. It's just not proper."
"You can take your proper and shove it up your—" she muttered,
but stopped when she heard voices outside.
"Yes, of course,"
Terin's deep voice, sleepy but alert. The tent flap opened and Anise sat up. Her brother's face appeared. He was still in his armour. For once, Terin wouldn't be the only one passing the night in full body armor, his weapon at the ready. Two thoughts crossed Anise's mind in an instant. Sir Dietrich had made good on his promise and told Arch the truth, and the enemy has attacked.
"Have the Easterners begun their march through the pass?"
Anise asked quickly. She almost wished they would. The waiting seemed worse, somehow.
"No. Did I wake you?"
He closed the tent behind him, the wind whistling in his wake. She shook her head, searching his expression.
"I couldn't sleep if I was knocked unconscious," she said.
Arch laughed, and he wasn't a king anymore. He was just her brother.
"Me either." Why are you here? Did you talk to Sir Dietrich?
Do I need an excuse to visit my elder sister, who I haven't seen in a fortnight? He said.
You're the king, Anise said.
You don't need an excuse for anything. Father certainly didn't.
Good point. But still, I keep going back and forth on every decision I've made, second-guessing myself. Did I word my letter to Jove Lorraine correctly? Was it too strong? Too weak? Should I let the East invade the North uncontested, like Sir Craig suggested, and allow them to defeat Uncle for me? Is my battle strategy sound? Am I just a child playing a game where I pretend to be a king?
Anise laughed. Back in your war tent, I never would have guessed you had so many doubts.
I'm good at hiding them, just like the joust.
You always won the joust, Anise pointed out. You always looked like you knew you would win.
All an act, Arch said.
Anise raised her eyebrows.
Why didn't you ever tell me?
Arch sighed.
Because you were always so strong. I wanted to impress you. I wanted to impress my eldest sister.
He went silent for a minute, looking thoughtful.
I'm glad you're here, he finally said. I thought you wanted me to hide in the hustle and bustle of Blackstone, she said.
See? Arch said. That was a mistake. Perhaps all of my decisions are mistakes.
Perhaps, Anise said, smirking.
Frozen hell, Arch protested. You're supposed to make me feel better.
Anise knew this was the perfect, light-hearted moment to admit the truth and simultaneously relinquish her right to the Northern Throne, but she didn't want to spoil what might be her last time alone with her brother. Plus, she didn't want to do anything else to shake his confidence. Instead, she said,
Arch, you were meant to be king. I believe that. I trust all of the decisions you've made so far, even the one concerning me and my safety.
So you're not angry?
I'm not angry. But that doesn't mean when this is all over that I won't rub snow in your face for old time's sake.
I wouldn't have it any other way, Arch said, smiling.
Now we should both try to get some rest. By morning there could be war.
With that he left. Just before the tent was sealed shut once more, Anise caught a glimpse of Taryn's dark eyes peering in. For half a moment she considered commanding him to come inside, but then thought better of it. She lay back down, and this time she fell right to sleep. After all, the attack likely wouldn't begin until morning. Unfortunately, King Ironclad had other plans.
Part 4. Rhea, Grey, Roan, Anise, Bane. There are those who are not fate-marked, who may influence the events that transpire. Whether for good or evil, is still to be determined. The Western Oracle. 30. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Lorraine. Rhea wanted to die. The next best thing, however, was closing her eyes and never opening them again. After passing out from the pain, she'd awakened in a room full of mirrors. Everywhere she'd turned was another looking-glass, spitting her horrid reflection back at her. She'd screamed and curled into the fetal position, her disfigured face smashed against her hands, her skin throbbing with pain. She used to relish the time in the morning spent in front of the broad mirror over her dressing table, staring at the big turquoise eyes her mother had blessed her with, the flawless skin, the sly smile, the silky, sun-kissed hair. She loved the way she looked, loved how, even garbed in her cloak of purity, every male head would turn when she passed. She loved how Greece had stared at her with smouldering desire every time he'd met her in secret.
No,
she thought bitterly, her teeth grinding together.
Not secret. Someone knew.
And now her sins had been used against her, her only talent, seduction, stripped away by the holy knife of the Fury, whose image would forever haunt her nightmares, dwarfed only by her own face screaming back at her from the looking-glass.
She'd been carved from temple to chin on both sides, perfectly symmetrical, the work of a master butcher. From each end of her chin, two additional, shorter slashes had been cut, angling along the edges of her lips and connecting in a point beneath her nose. Her perfect nose. Her perfect lips. Her perfect face. Now that of a monster. The symbol was unmistakable. A W for whore. A mark that would forever label her as a fornicator, a sinner, unclean. She'd seen similar markings on prostitutes caught working the streets in Night's End. She'd always pitied them. Though she was certain many of the women had once been fair, she'd never been able to see past their disfigured faces. And now she was one of them. Her parents were dead. Her younger siblings hated her. Her cousin had usurped the throne that was rightfully hers. Greece? No, Grey, she remembered. The only boy she'd ever loved was gone, not that she blamed him. No man would ever look upon her with desire again. She squeezed her eyes shut tighter, tears leaking out, the salt burning the deep cuts in her flesh. The door creaked open, but still she wouldn't look, afraid of seeing her own reflection.
"Oh, Rhea," a voice said. "Wrath save us all."
She knew the voice, which only made her tuck her head further into her hands, her entire body racked with thunderous sobs. Strong arms wrapped around her, and Ennis said,
"I'm here, dear cousin. You are safe."
Rhea hated how much she believed him, although his words were nothing more than a kind lie.
"The Furia have gone mad. They're patrolling Night's End day and night, punishing sinners. My brother ordered it. Jove said the city needs to be cleansed, that your father was too lenient, and that is why we are being punished."
Rhea sniffled, taking it all in. Her father was the strictest man she'd ever met, even if he was too trusting of his own daughter to realize what she was up to half the time. Ennis continued,
"The Furia are spreading rumors about you, that you lay with a man, a thief with a sin-marked sister." They aren't rumors, she thought.
Still, it was all she could take.
Yes, she'd bedded Grey, and so what? She loved him. She wanted him. And yet, if not for having met him, she would still be beautiful.
She squirmed away, unfolding her arms, her eyes flashing open.
"Where were you when they did this to me?"
she spat. Dozens of grotesque Rhea's mimicked her accusation. Ennis tried to hide the shock in his eyes, but failed miserably.
"Oh, Wrath!" "No," Rhea said. "Wrath is not here, if he ever was. Night's End died when my father died." "You don't mean that."
Ennis's gaze was locked on her face, and she knew he couldn't bring himself to look away from her disfigurement.
"I do,"
Rhea said, hot tears streaking down her cheeks.
"I want this city to burn, along with everyone in it."
Ennis stood up and held out a hand.
"Come, you're permitted to leave now. A good rest and some food will help. I will have your handmaiden attend to your face. The wounds will heal. The scars will fade." "Oh, Wrath,"
Rhea thought. She wanted to believe her cousin's words so badly it hurt deep in her chest. But she knew his words were hollow, as false as a fire without heat. The Fury had used a holy blade, blessed by Wrath. Her scars would remain deep and jagged forever. However, his offer did give her an idea, a dark thought that would have made her cringe with disgust just a few days earlier. It was a wicked idea, and yet it was exactly what she needed in order to go on. She clung to it as she stood, allowing her kindly cousin to escort her from the room of mirrors and to her bedroom. She would have her revenge, or she would die in the process. 31. The Western Kingdom. Talis. Grey Aris. Formerly known as Greece Jolly. Greece Jolly was dead. Grey knew that, After all, Grease Jolly had been a slick operator, his left hand faster than a striking cobra. The Master Thief had died when his hand had been cut off. "I am Grey Aris," he said aloud, his true name sounding strange on his tongue after so many years of disuse. He was on the outskirts of a walled city he assumed was Talis, though he'd never been there before. It had taken him 3 days to travel from Night's End to Talis on foot. On day two, the heavens had smiled upon him, letting loose a light rain that he'd collected in his hands, licking the moisture from his skin. He'd scavenged for berries twice, and though his stomach was still mostly empty, the tiny fruits had been enough to sustain him. Now his muscles were aching, and he longed to rest. But he wouldn't, not until he found Shay. Though the Furia had a head start and were on horseback, surely they'd have to stop sometime. Once he found them, he would use his stealth to determine what had happened to his sister. Then he would do everything in his power to help her escape. Even more concerning, however, was his stump. It was leaking thick pus, greenish-brown and occasionally spotted with blood. He knew it was infected, but chose not to think too much about it, leaving the wound covered and out of sight. The city walls were far too tall to climb, and anyway, climbing walls was something Grease would have done. No, one-handed Grey Aris would enter the city the conventional way, through the front gates. The road curved around the outside of the city, toward the sea, which was frothing with angry whitecaps. A trio of gulls chased each other, cawing the news of Grey's arrival. When he rounded the edge of the wall, he pulled up short, gaping. The front gate faced the sea, trailing a snaking staircase that descended to one of the largest ports he'd ever seen, nearly as bustling as the docks at Night's End. Half a dozen ships were anchored, hordes of seamen crawling across the decks, unloading crates and barrels. Small horses stood waiting on the docks, waiting to be loaded. Not horses, Grey realized. Donkeys. Several of the sure-footed animals were climbing the steep steps driven by their masters, who used long sticks to encourage them forward. Each donkey carried an impressive load, their heads down, their backs bent. Grey could relate. Though not physical in nature, the load he carried at this very moment weighed heavily on his shoulders. Shaking away the thought, he continued along the path toward Talis's front gate, watching the commotion on the docks. The ships were large and flew the yellow crescent flags of Crimea, their sides bristling with long oars to ensure safe passage even when the winds disappeared. He wondered if the North was aware that the Crimeans were diverting a portion of their merchant fleet south to Talis. Probably not. He reached the city gates just behind several of the donkeys and their masters. Following behind them, he marveled at the fact that the city entrance was unprotected during the daytime. He marched through without question, though his clothing was filthy and bloody. If the Phoenicians ever managed to break through the border cities and cross the Forbidden Plains, Grey thought, Talis will fall quickly, which would leave Night's End unprotected from the south. Caught between the Southrunners and the Northerners, the western stronghold would be squashed like a grape under a well-placed boot. For some reason, that thought made Grey frown. Why should I care what happens to the kingdom that has done nothing but hurt me and my family? Grey wondered to himself. Because of her. Because of Rhea. She was likely queen now, and any turmoil for the kingdom would affect her. Gods, I'm a fool, Grey thought, wishing he could wipe his feelings for Rhea away as easily as a smudge of dirt from his face. His thoughts were, however, wiped away when he passed a marketplace and saw the glares fired his way by the owners of each cart and stall. At first he ignored them, trying to figure out what their problems were. Was it his disheveled appearance? Surely they'd seen travellers before. He'd already passed several beggars. He was no worse for wear than they were. It dawned on him. His stump. Sure enough, he saw the seller's eyes flick from his face to his missing hand and back again, their angry frowns deepening. His stump was like having a tattoo across his forehead that read, Thief. Don't worry, he wanted to scream. Grease Jolly is dead. Still, he would need to get food one way or another, and he had no coin to purchase it. Pretending not to notice the way one of the traders was staring at him, Gray sidled up to his stall. "I'm looking for a girl," he said to the owner, a plump, middle-aged woman with grey hair. He described Shay in detail, while she just stared at him. Then he said, "She was taken by the Furia." The woman flinched and seemed to lose her composure.
"Ain't seen nothing," she said.
When Gray tried to force the issue, she quickly stepped back and swung a wooden gate closed across the front of her stall. Though she'd been unwilling to talk, Gray knew her fearful reaction was enough to confirm that the Furia had been through the city recently. Maybe were still here. He tried the next stall, but the owner had already shuttered the sides of his store. Gray could barely make out a pair of eyes staring at him from inside. "Yes," he thought, "I am close." After similar experiences with several more merchants, Gray knew a different tactic was necessary. He strode up to a stall further down the line, before the owner closed his gate or shutters.
"Nothing is for sale,"
the man said immediately, blocking Gray's view of the fresh fruits and vegetables, which only made his mouth water more. "No," Gray said, raising his eyebrows. "That's good, because I'm not looking to buy anything." The man was old, his flesh sagging under his arms and eyes.
"You best be moving on," he said. "The Furia are in the city. They are likely to take your other hand if you're not careful."
Gray's heart palpitated at the confirmation of what he already believed.
"Where are they?"
he asked.
"The Furia." "Why should I tell you?"
Something broke inside Gray. He stepped up to the man and grabbed his collar with one hand, shoving him hard against the cart. Several apples shook free from the pile and bounced to the ground.
"Listen up, old man. I'm tired and hungry, and I'm trying to find my younger sister. I don't give two shites about you and your fruit. So if you don't tell me where they've gone, I swear to wrath that I'll make you wish you had."
Gray was shocked by his own actions, but it was like his temper had a mind of its own. Was this who Gray was? Violence and threats. Someone said from nearby,
"Hey, Briar, is there a problem?"
Gray ignored the newcomer, his eyes boring into the old man named Briar. Briar opened his mouth slowly and said,
"Everything's fine. I'm just giving this fellow directions."
Gray released the man, using his one hand to brush the dirty fingerprints from his shirt.
"Thank you."
The man nodded.
"I don't want any trouble. The Furia arrived 2 days ago. They even have two Furies with them. The city's been on its best behavior, but the Holy Warriors aren't here to enforce Roth's will. No, they've been waiting."
Gray frowned.
"Waiting for what?" "The ships," Briar said. "Soon as the ships made port this morning, they headed for the docks. Seems they're looking to take a voyage."
Gray shook his head. "A voyage to where?"
"I don't know. Sorry."
"Was there a young girl with them?" Gray asked, holding his breath.
"You mean, like an acolyte?"
Gray hadn't considered the fact that the Furia might be travelling with acolytes, the young girls training to be fully fledged holy warriors one day. Typically, the acolytes wore cloaks that were half red, half white, to distinguish them from the ordained members of the Holy Sisterhood. Would they have disguised Shay as an acolyte? Gray wondered.
"I don't know. Maybe."
The man chewed his lip and considered it.
"Yes, they had an acolyte with them. Just one."
Gray had to fight to control the emotions that swirled through him.
"Was it you, Shay? Are you alive?"
"Thank you," he said again. "I'm sorry I threatened you."
"I understand," the old man said. "I had a sister once. I would have done anything to protect her."
He lowered his voice.
"And between you and me, I wouldn't want her in the sisterhood either."
Gray nodded and turned away, heading back the way he'd come. It appeared his stay in Talis would be a short one. He had a ship to catch.
"Hey!"
the man called out from behind him. Gray half turned, anxious to be on his way. The man tossed him one of the dusty green apples that had tumbled from his cart when Grey had assaulted him.
"Take care now," he said, as Grey caught the fruit.
Grey pursed his lips, found a clean spot on his shirt, and shined the apple. He took a big bite and raised it in appreciation, but the man had already started talking to another customer, haggling over prices. Grey turned and ran. As he hustled past the marketplace, he took small bites of the apple, immediately feeling the effects of the bittersweet fruit. He galloped through the front gates and began making his way down the steep staircase, dodging the piles of dung buzzing with flies. He passed several donkeys and their masters, but they didn't give him more than a sideways glance before urging their beasts onward. The sun beat down on Grey's face, and his mouth went dry with thirst and anticipation. His sister was so close. If he could find her, he was certain he'd find a way to help her escape. Finally, he reached the bottom of the steps, which gave way to a long wooden platform that extended out into the sea, supported by stone columns that disappeared beneath the surface of the dark blue water. Along the main dock were wooden offshoots to both the left and right. Seaworthy vessels of various shapes and sizes were anchored on each side. He stopped several times, using his hand to shade his eyes so he could scan the ships. Several of the workers were wearing red, but none of them were women. He continued on until he reached the end of the platform, where one final ship was docked and being unloaded. A young shirtless man with bulging muscles, shining with sweat, noticed Grey and said,
"What you doing?"
"I'm looking for someone. An acolyte travelling with the Furia." The man squinted, his gaze zeroing in on Grey's missing hand, as if only just noticing it.
"The Furia, huh? They were here. Word is they chartered a ship all for themselves. Paid a royal price, too, they did. You just missed them."
He pointed southward, to a stretch of ocean off the coast. A shadow blotted out the lower portion of the horizon, the ship's sails full with the wind. Grey closed his eyes and bit his tongue, anger and frustration roiling through him. His fist clenched and then unclenched as he sank to the wooden deck. His stump was throbbing, and he could feel the warm trickle of fluid leaking out. It was over. Shay was gone, probably forever. Darkness closed in around him.
"I know where they went," the man said.
Grey opened his eyes, and the darkness lifted. He blinked.
"Where?" "Everyone's been talking about it. They're headed for the Dead Isles," he said.
Grey's heart sank. The Dead Isles were a place of, well, death. Few lived to tell nightmarish tales about the island where it was said the dead remained alive, haunting the stone cliffs.
"How do I get there?" he asked. "Our ship's going back to Crimea to pick up another load. You can try Smithers' old wreck. He sometimes makes the trek south, though most think he's a fool for doing so. And he's always looking for new crew on account of paying so poorly."
"Where?" Grey said quickly. The man pointed down the row.
"Sixth vessel on the left. The Jewel."
Grey counted and locked in on the ship, though its name was generous. The Junker was a much more appropriate title.
"Thank you,"
Grey said, and started back the way he'd come. He reached the boat, which was covered in barnacles and a mess of chipped paint. The bow was ornamented with a rusted statue of a woman, her bulging chest naked, descending to a lower half that had a long, fish-like tail rather than legs and feet. The Jewel was scrawled onto the side in chipped blue paint.
"Admiring me wife, are you?"
a man said, staring down from the deck. He was an old coot, with patchy grey whiskers and curly grey hair. He was leaning on one of the few sections of railing that wasn't cracked or missing entirely.
"She's a real beaut," Grey lied.
He wasn't sure whether the man meant the boat or the naked statue.
"Bloody right she is. What can I do ye for?"
he asked. "Are you Smithers?"
"In the flesh. This here's my lovely lady."
So he'd meant the boat when he referred to his wife earlier.
"I heard you're heading south." "Ye heard right. All the way to Fane's. Maybe even Calip, if the winds are right."
"Seems I'm going that way myself."
"How far?"
It was a tricky question. If he lied and said he was heading for Fane's too, the man would be skeptical. Westerners were not welcome in the south. The Dead Isles. Smithers blinked, raised his eyebrows, and then laughed, the railing creaking as he slapped it with the heels of his palms.
He had me going there for a second. The Dead Isles! What a hoot!
Grey waited until the moment of frivolity had worn off, and then said, It was no jape.
Son, did ye lose your mind when ye lost that hand of yours? Not but one with a death wish would set foot on the Dead Isles. Well, except for the Furia, and that's just another reason not to go there.
Grey was willing to die for his sister, if that's what it took to save her. All the same, that's where I'm headed. Smithers shook his head, but it wasn't an answer.
We'll pass near the Isles, but we won't get too close, on account of the bad luck carried on the wind. You'd have to swim the rest of the way.
He glanced at Grey's missing hand again.
Can ye swim?
Grey had learned to swim back in Restor, which had several large ponds. It would be significantly more difficult without his left hand, but he'd find a way. He had to.
I can swim, he promised.
You ever worked on a boat?
No, but I'm willing to learn.
We can't pay ye. All ye get in return for your labours is a one-way voyage to the gates of hell.
Deal, Grey said.
He made his way to the gangplank and clambered aboard the rickety vessel.
Shay, I'm coming. I'm coming.
32. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Rhea was clean and perfumed, dressed in a chaste blue dress that swept around her ankles. By Western law, she'd never be permitted to wear white again, her purity oath forsaken when she sinned with Grey. Though Ennis had insisted on having her handmaiden assist her, Rhea had refused. She didn't want anyone to see her. Not now. Not like this. For the first time in her privileged life, she'd bathed and dressed on her own. Unexpectedly, there was something liberating about it. She'd avoided her mirror the entire time, until now. She approached cautiously, her eyes downcast. Ennis had left a jar of healing salve on her dressing table. She reached for it, still refusing to raise her gaze to the looking-glass she had once loved. Taking a deep breath, she lifted her chin. Disgust coiled through her like a snake. Her eyes took pity on her and filled with tears, blurring her vision. She dabbed a finger in the gooey salve and pressed it to her face. The effect was instantaneous, cooling and numbing her shredded flesh. Shaking, she traced a path along the wound, from left temple to chin, up the edge of her lips to her nose, down the right side of her lips, and dangling up to her right temple. Finished, she blinked furiously, watching her face take shape once more. Her saliva tasted bitter on her tongue as she glared at herself.
"I hate you," she breathed.
The words were meant for many, for her cousin Jove, for taking what was rightfully hers and so much more, for her self-righteous siblings, Bea and Leo, for her father for dying, for Grey Aris for stealing her heart and her purity, for the Furia with their red cloaks and violence, for Roth himself, the god of purity and punishment, and lastly, for herself, for being ugly and weak and young and stupid. Rhea grabbed the jar of salve from the dressing table and whipped it at the mirror, which shattered upon impact, jagged shards tinkling to the table and floor. Someone pounded on her door, shouting through the timber. Ennis, worried about her. He must have been outside her chamber this whole time, waiting. He was a good man, unlike his horrid brother. Slowly, Rhea bent down and selected one of the glass shards, a long spike ending in a vicious point. Careful not to cut herself, she plucked it from the floor between two fingers, using one of her silk scarves to wrap it up. She tucked it beneath the folds of her dress and picked her way past the rubble to open the door. Ennis practically fell inside.
"Princess, are you hurt? I heard a loud sound."
He scanned the room, immediately noticing the destroyed mirror. Rhea felt anger and fury and something darker throbbing inside of her, something she never knew she had. But she held all of that back and said with a meek whimper,
"I'm sorry. I couldn't look at... I didn't want to see."
She covered her face with her hands and squeezed tears from her eyes. This time it was her choice to cry, for her own purposes and not out of sorrow.
"Oh, Rhea! Oh, Roth!"
Ennis said.
"You need not worry. Your chambermaid will see to the mess. The mirror will not be replaced." "Thank you, cousin,"
Rhea said.
"For everything."
He nodded, his eyes full of pity. She almost felt bad deceiving him. Then again, he'd let her be taken away by the Furia just like everyone else.
"Shall I leave you?"
"No,"
she said.
"Roth, I'm a blubbering mess. Wait one moment."
Rhea retrieved a handkerchief and used it to wipe away her tears and clear her nose. She selected a pale blue hat with a matching veil, which she draped over her face. She'd always hated the Western clothing she was forced to wear. But now it was a Roth's end. None would be able to see her face. When she turned around, a shiver ran through her from head to toe. It wasn't fear. It was anticipation. For the first time since that night when Grey abandoned her in the crypts, she felt in control of her own life.
"Take me to your brother, King Jove Loren," she said. "I want to pledge him my support and beg his forgiveness."
Ennis's eyes widened in surprise, but he didn't object.
"As you wish, princess."
He led her into the corridor, and Rhea patted her side, relishing the feel of the shard of mirror hidden beneath the cloth. They'd taken everything from her, and now she had nothing left to lose. Jove was sitting on Rhea's throne, wearing her crown. Though seeing him like that, with his smug expression and pious pity, made her want to scream. She forced herself to appear repentant and broken. The false king was alone, save for three guards who'd either managed to survive the attack that killed her father, or who'd been recently added to the castle cortege.
"Thank you for seeing me, your highness,"
Rhea said, her head bowed toward the stone floor. She kneeled in what she knew would appear to be reverence and fealty, a pose she'd seen countless others strike while grovelling before her father.
"Yes, well, you have paid for your sins, and I am not an unmerciful king."
"You are not a king at all," Rhea thought. "I would prefer to do this alone, with only Roth as my witness," she said.
"My lady?"
Ennis said from behind her.
"Yes, cousin. I mean you should leave. Especially you."
"Leave us, brother," Jove said. "You can escort her back to her chambers once we are finished."
Rhea remained on her knees, though they were throbbing from the hard stone. Pain was nothing now. She had felt pain. Agony was her only friend. She heard Ennis mutter something, but then leave, his footsteps fading away.
"You may rise," Jove said.
"Thank you, your highness. It took you long enough. And your guards?"
Through the pale blue lace of her veil, she saw her cousin's eyes narrow ever so slightly.
"You would have your new king unprotected."
Rhea cast her eyes down once more, feigning embarrassment.
"Of course not, my king. They would still be guarding the door from intruders, and there is no other way inside the court. And surely you don't fear a 16-year-old scarred girl with a broken spirit, do you?"
The king seemed to consider the truth of her words for a moment, and then flicked his fingers at his trio of protectors, as if he didn't care whether he ever saw them again.
"He's already drunk on his power,"
Rhea thought as the guards left, closing the door behind them. Queen Rhea Loren was alone with the false king. For a moment, her nerve faltered, and she had the urge to truly beg his forgiveness, to ask for a place in his court, so she could go back to the life she'd loved, filled with feasts and dancing and midnight rendezvous with notorious criminals. But her face made all of that impossible. If the Furia and Jove had wanted to create a monster, then they were successful. Rhea would be the monster.
Well,
Jove said, impatiently drumming his fingers on the throne's armrest.
May I approach, Your Highness?
She asked, eyes still down, broken, pathetic, penitent.
As you wish,
he said, like he didn't care whether she did or not, whether she lived or died or faded away into obscurity. She shuffled forward, lifting her skirts as she mounted the three steps to the raised throne. She felt the shard of mirror shift, and her breath left her.
If it falls out, it's over.
Surreptitiously, she clamped a hand to her side, pinning the dislodged spike against her hip. While she bowed deeply, she clawed her fingers through the material, closing them around the base of the makeshift blade. It was a crude weapon, and even the handle was sharp, pricking her fingers through the silk covering. She relished the warmth of her own blood as it flowed down her palm.
Your Highness, Rhea said, I am here to beg your forgiveness, and pledge my service and life to you. It's what my father would have wanted.
The king said nothing, still tapping his fingers. Had she misjudged him? She waited for him to proceed with the traditional rite of royal forgiveness. He cleared his throat, said,
Have you realized the error in your sinful ways?
He was going to make her work for this.
Yes,
she said, trying to keep the angry growl from her voice. Warm blood trickled down the skin of her hand.
Are you willing to receive the light of wrath back into your life?
Yes.
Will you accept a political marriage proposal if I arrange one?
How dare you?
She wanted to scream. He was already planning to marry her off to one of the other kingdoms in an effort to form an alliance. He was likely to send her to the north, like her Aunt Sabria. Lord Griswold had to be 100 years old. And her aunt had died because of such a marriage.
Yes,
she said, the obedient girl she'd always been. The king sighed, continuing to drag things out. Finally, he extended his hand toward Rhea. His second finger bore a Loren family heirloom, the Ring of Kings. An enormous blue diamond sparkled from 1,000 facets, fixed within a thick band of pure gold. All she had to do was kiss the ring, and it would seal the deal. She'd be a happy princess in the good graces of her righteous king. She kissed the cool gemstone, and he said,
By the power bestowed upon me by Hroth and his holy servants, I absolve you of your sins and accept your pledge of service.
Beneath her veil, Rhea smiled. In one swift motion, she withdrew her hand from her dress, erupted from her lowered stance, and lunged at the king. Leaning forward so she could kiss the ring, Jove had left himself completely unprotected. She drove the spike into his neck, shocked by the amount of blood that erupted from his skin, a crimson geyser, splattering warmth on her face. He tried to cry out, but all that arose was a wet gurgle. Rhea backed away, slightly horrified. Slightly more excited by what she'd done, by the power over life and death she'd claimed for her own. Wrapping his hands around the glass shard, his eyes wide with shock and terror, Jove sprawled forward, tumbling down the steps, smearing blood on the stonework. For a few seconds, Rhea could do nothing more than stare as her cousin twitched, shook, and then went completely still. She didn't have much time, but still she approached slowly, imagining Jove rising from the dead, his ghost ready for vengeance. Thankfully, he remained dead, and she managed to roll him over. His mouth was open, his eyes wide, but she didn't bother to close either. Instead, she wrapped her hands in cloth from her dress and wrenched the spike from his neck. More blood bubbled out, adding to the lake. Rhea forced herself to look at it, until the bitter taste of bile rose from the back of her throat. She vomited. It was all part of the charade. Spitting out the last of the bitterness from her mouth, she gripped the glass shard, took a deep breath, and raked it across her abdomen, slicing clean through her dress in the process. Pain flared up, and blood flowed freely. The cut was deep enough for her ruse, but not so deep as to kill her. At least she hoped not. She dropped the spike at her feet, collapsed in the puddle of vomit and blood, and screamed at the top of her bloody lungs.
33. The Eastern Kingdom. Raiders Pass. Roan. Wearing the dark cloak of night, the white cliffs loomed like sentries on either side as the Eastern Battalion marched into Raiders Pass. In the typical manner of the East, the King led the column, unafraid to die for his brave men and women. Despite the way his conversation with the King had ended the night before, Roan marvelled at the courage of Orrin Ironclad and his sons, who never once considered sending their soldiers ahead as a shield. It was almost as if the death of the Queen had become their armour. Then again, Gareth was the shield, a fact that reminded Roan why he was still here, marching with an army he had no real connection with. "Am I brave?" Roan wondered to himself. After all, he could have left the night before, could have crossed the river, vanished into the tangle, never to be seen in the East again. After the King had rejected his proposal for peace, he'd once more considered leaving. Instead, he just shook his head and gone to bed. "No," he chided himself. "I'm just stupid." The thought made him chuckle, despite himself. The horses had been left behind, the pass too narrow and steep for their size. Roan was in the second wave of soldiers because he was too valuable to lose during the initial attack. He'd been given a beautiful sword designed and forged by the late Bark, an irony that wasn't lost on Roan. Even in death, the man would protect Roan, though Roan had been unable to save him outside of Glee. Roan had also been assigned a protector, though she accepted the position grudgingly. Gwendolyn ignored several of his glances as she walked beside him. Once into the wide mouth of the pass, the trail became rocky, gaining in elevation with each step. It narrowed, too, until they were forced to march four astride, then three, then two, and eventually single file. Gwendolyn insisted on going first, though it wasn't clear whether she was just following the King's orders, or if she genuinely cared for his well-being. Roan suspected it was the former. The trail was treacherous in the dark, forcing the column to slow as the soldiers placed each foot carefully, feeling their way forward. On their right was a steep, snowy incline. On their left was a sheer drop to the frozen river. In Roan's opinion, any advantage gained by a night attack was lost due to the snail-like speed of their approach and the risk of falling to their deaths. Unfortunately, however, the King showed no signs of changing his mind, the front lines moving forward step by step. Occasionally armour clanked, but other than that, the only sounds were their muffled footsteps through the snow and their ragged breathing. Also, the Snake River burbled under the ice, masking all. Earlier, Roan had been inspired by his own attempt to cross the ice, and asked whether it would be easier to simply walk along the surface of the iced-over river, but his idea had been quickly shot down. Evidently, the ice had already been tested. It could hold the weight of several large men, but not a force of their size. Plus, a well-aimed boulder falling from the cliffs above would send the entire battalion into the deadly waters. The wind picked up, a gale force that threatened to sweep them all from the trail as it whistled through the canyon. Roan lowered his head, focusing on each step, doing his best to remain as far to the right as possible, hugging the hillside. Two harsh hours passed without event, other than Roan's toes losing all feeling. He wondered if they'd fallen off, rattling around in his boots. Now there was no going back. The distance to the northern edge of the pass as close as their camp. The snowfall, which had thus far been nothing more than a few errant flurries, began in earnest, coating their armour and blinding their vision. With the snow on the rarely used trail deepening, the going became even slower, and Roan was forced to stop several times when those ahead of them paused to clear the pass. It was during one such halt that the first attack came. Initially, Roan couldn't identify the sound, which was nothing more than a zip and the displacement of air. Just ahead of him, a soldier toppled from the cliff, a feathered arrow protruding from a narrow gap in his faceplate.
A chorus of zips filled the air at the same time as someone shouted, "Down!" Roan reacted too slow, and Gwendolyn hauled him to the rocky trail half a moment before an arrow whizzed past, landing somewhere